You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
My first session training with the team, I wasn't on the squad at the time, my first session training with the team, and I'm getting all these shouts of squeeze, but nobody told me this language, so all I can hear is what I think is people saying easy. And I'm like, oh my god, day one, am I already going too fast? I am so good at this.
Hello, and welcome to Faster, the Dr. Hutch podcast, supported by Cycling Weekly magazine. I'm Michael Hutchinson, also known as Dr. Hutch, and I'm a former professional cyclist and a national time trial champion. This podcast looks at the simple question of what makes a fast bike rider. Actually, it's not that simple a question.
The most efficient way to get from A to B is to go on the exact lap split that your physiologist has told you you're all capable of and just hold it exactly there until you get to exactly zero. Tank goes empty right at the very finish, and that never happens. So if you accept that that isn't going to happen, it's probably slightly more efficient to go a little bit too hard and then sort of like tail off towards the end.
This time, I'm talking to Team GB rider Katie Archibald. Katie is Olympic champion in the team pursuit, a world champion in team pursuit, Omnium and Madison. She's one of the most distinctive riders in the current British team and has a reputation as an intelligent athlete, one who analyses what she's doing with a lot of care.
So my father's a 4-minute mile runner. My brother's a 4-minute 400 metre swimmer. And I'm a pursuiter. And the world record is 4 minutes 10 seconds. We're a 4-minute family, and we all like to put it down to the mitochondria my mother gave us, but there's something that my dad's had a hand in.
She also writes and talks about cycling better than most cycling journalists. In fact, she used to write a column for the magazine I write for, Cycling Weekly. I thought getting shown up by younger, more effective competition was something I was safe from after I stopped racing, and I could not have been more wrong about that. But anyway, old rivalries aside, this time I started by asking her how she'll dealt with a pandemic-blighted year, faced with almost no competitions, no Olympics, just training and uncertainty, and training and uncertainty.
Yeah, I think your own frame of reference comes from who you train with. So I've trained with the Joanna Rousels of the world that are so tied to training and so tied to also just the individualistic nature of their training as well. Of this enthusiasm for self-improvement, for the intrinsic rewards. And so when you contend with something like that every day, you think, oh, gee, yeah, well, I'm all about racing. I'm all about racing. I don't like training hard. I don't do this for me, you know, and you build up an identity in an ante to somebody else's identity. I guess I did that for a long time, especially in the British Cycling Programme, where we have such support that you can focus on training more so than racing. And so, again, it's like the grass is greener. You think like, oh, well, I'm like total race obsessed. I would race every weekend if I could. I kind of hear these stories of, I think Hannah Barnes used to claim that her training programme was just sort of the Cheney on a Thursday, like racing at the weekend. Maybe there was like a track lead thrown in there or something. It was kind of like constructed around the like pretend races. Sorry, I'm on a podcast doing air quotes with my fingers.
That's okay. I think we heard the air quotes.
We heard the air quotes, yeah. I think left to my own devices, I'd probably join that crew. But lockdown's kind of convinced me that I'm better than that, I think. I think I have actually got a taste for training now, a taste for self-improvement, and I'm going to come out I've gone straight. How many minutes? 3 minutes. This is the straight into bragging. I think I'm going to be all the stronger for it out the other end.
Yeah, I would have classified myself as someone who liked racing when I was competing, and I found that through lockdown, I actually started putting training programs together and getting to sort of 95% compliance on the training programs I constructed for myself, because it became kind of self-perpetuating. And I think it can be, I think most of the people who race well have, you know, an enthusiasm, they get a sense of achievement out of the training. Even if they don't like it, they come home feeling they've done something worthwhile.
Well, it's when you start to replicate the enjoyment that you get from races in your training sessions. And I think what's really shown up in lockdown is because the week is no longer interrupted with any... It's not even just the racing being taken away. It's all external stimulation. And so you can follow these 7-day patterns for like 6 weeks in a row. I'll be following the same 7-day routine. And so you really get a taste for the way to optimize those 7 days. So by the time you get to week six, you know exactly where you're going to take it easy, where you're going to push on, and the what you can get out of those, like those two key training sessions, is so much more by week six. Then you get to week six and it's like you need to kind of shift the stimulus again. But I really, really sold on it wasn't rocket science, was it, of just can off everything else and really focus on considerate training, and it pays off.
It's been like a year-long training camp for athletes, because there's nothing else going on.
Yeah, but here's the funny thing, we haven't done any training camps, and I think there's been a big benefit. So we would
but it's been one big training camp. You've been on camp since March.
Well, it's one big training camp, and that means there's no travel days, because that's kind of what screws us for it. Because you have to fit a travel day in, and you're like, oh, well, you're away for 10 days. And then that sort of messes up the rotation you were working on when you're at home, and you've got a gap at 4 a.m. And so you basically, I feel like we've all read the same books and seen the same TED Talks now of the idea that 4 hours sleep is the same as a hangover. And like these kind of things where you're like, I can't believe they're getting us up at this time. Like they'd be so angry if I'd gone out clubbing the night before, but you're going to make me feel the same way getting on a flight at whatever. Height of privilege, but it really does feel like it's made a difference, these small adjustments.
Quite a few years ago, I had the brilliant idea of working on a 10-day week. So I invented 3 extra days so that I could work on a 10-day training cycle, which meant that my weekend coincided with everybody else's weekend about once every 3 months. And it was it's even if you're kind of you're a pro athlete and you think that that's all you're doing, it's surprisingly hard to sustain that. I lasted, you know, probably 5 or 6 10-day cycles. I ought perhaps to explain this 10-day week thing just in case you're getting the impression that I'm in any way strange. In about 2005, I decided it would be easier to fit all the training sessions and recovery days into a 10-day cycle rather than a 7-day cycle. And the simple way to do this was to just invent 3 new days and rewrite the calendar so that it would be all 10-day weeks. So I invented Hutch Day, Michael Day, and Richard Day. Richard's my middle name. And I had a 10-day week. Now, what you won't have worked out yet, probably, is that if you do this, if you add 3 extra days, all the other days come adrift too, so that by the second week of my new calendar, the day everybody else thought was Thursday, I thought was Monday. And the whole thing actually ever came back into alignment about once each 3 months. In the end, I gave the whole thing up after about 2 months, which is 2 months of your calendar. It's only about a month and a half of mine, because in my calendar, there were only 9 months in a year, the only way to make it work. And the problem was that races happen on weekends, and they can't be moved, so you're stuck with that. And trying to deal with that was just impossible. So in the end, I went back to the same boring 7-day week that everybody else has and just dealt with it. It was about the same era that I built my own wind tunnel in the living room, but that's probably a story for another time.
I got into an argument with our S&C coach. I would have with Lawrence had he been on the call, pulling my hair out again, like, you know, there's nothing holding me to the Roman calendar anymore. There's nothing, like, because we kind of work on a 7-day rotation because the gym I go to, I can only go to Monday to Friday. Track sessions will be Monday to Friday. So they create these pinpoints in your week. And I'm there, I'm like, I'm training from home. I've got my own squat rack at home. I'm doing like everything is either road, turbo, gym. I'm in control. I'm like, stop setting, like, we have to change this. I tried for a month. It was a disastrous month. maybe if I'd had more backing and it wasn't like I hadn't gone into it with such an argument. But the funny thing is that the fallout has really sold me on really sticking to 7 days. Maybe we can have this conversation a year from now and I'll have swung back and I'll be like, it's all about 3 day rotations. It's all about 3 days.
Yeah, I'm sticking to 7 days for the moment, because it was certainly in normal times, it was just weirdly difficult. It felt so unsettling. It was like a sort of a, I wouldn't say it was a torture, but it was like a sort of a psychological experiment that someone was doing on you. You felt oddly cast adrift from normal society because, you know, you'd got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then I'd got Michael Day and Hutch Day and Richard Day, because those are my three names. And you would find yourself saying to someone, oh, I can come on Michael Day, and they'd go, what? It was quite odd. I mean, for someone like, you know, obviously, you know, you work on a 4-year cycle. You know, how difficult is suddenly chucking a 5-year cycle into that? And the whole of the Olympics, which I think is going to happen at the time of recording, the Olympics was going to happen. And how difficult it is to deal with that extra year. Never mind the fact that it's been such a weird year. The extra 12 months in themselves, are that difficult?
Yeah. Unspoken rule amongst our training group is that none of us reference the idea that the Olympics wouldn't happen. I should have made it spoken for you at the start. Yes. Mm. About once, I don't know, once every few weeks, Nia Evans sends an article into our WhatsApp group that I've stopped clicking on them because the headline will just read something along the lines of "The Olympics will happen," says either like IOC chief or like Prime Minister of Japan or so on. So yeah, that's the first thing, the Olympics that we are preparing for. What consumes my thoughts more is the follow through, because what I'm looking at is Tokyo 2021, Birmingham Commonwealth Games 22, Glasgow Multidiscipline World Championships 23 into Paris Olympics 24.
That sounds like fun.
It does sound like fun. And do you know what? It very much makes Tokyo feel like the start of something, like this springboard into what I'm envisaging will be the biggest 4 years of my career. And I guess especially the 4 years is probably too long to be kind of constantly on the hunt, as it were. But this serious respite certainly gives you a hunger for a plan like that. And inevitably, I guess when you say something like that aloud, and there will be something that has to give. But yeah, I got total enthusiasm for those 4 years, especially based on my experiences coming out of Rio. It really did. For me, Rio was the start of like a sort of a swing up in my career. It didn't mellow afterwards. If anything, it's sort of mellowed in the midpoint as we just sort of build back in. Oh, it's not even the midpoint. It sort of mellowed just before Tokyo, which is when you don't want it to mellow.
when you say mellow, what do you mean by mellow? Because I can think of several different meanings for it. I mean, it could be anything from a kind of I really relaxed into being who I am and being a top level competitor, or it could mean it all went a bit wrong, but I tried to style it out.
Yeah, I am styling it out. No, I feel, what's the word? There isn't a nice word. I feel very confident about Tokyo. I'm so excited. I'm more than anything just excited to see what we can do with that Team Pursuit team. But the 2020 World Championships and the 2019 World Championships, I had bad experiences, we'll say. I didn't enjoy, 2019 was all right. I ended up riding in the Omnium and through my place as reserve. I wasn't picked for the Omnium. I rode the Omnium. I crashed. I ended up with concussion. I couldn't then contend in the Madison. The next year was poor. I didn't have a good preparation into that World Championships. I was not selected for the Madison. This time, it wasn't that I just missed out. It was that I was kind of told in explicit terms, you are not ready for this. You are not prepared for this. You are not good enough for this. And this was like the Olympic World Championships. This is your last, sort of your last competition to contend before the Games. It was a super, super big deal. And it actually sort of reset just as we, like resets confidences, I suppose, just as the Games got cancelled. And so I was going to say, I wouldn't put myself in a category of people that were blessed with a delay. I think there's some people that say like, oh, you know, I was injured or I was something like, I didn't feel that way at all. Like a really pretty keen to kind of like get under my belt and get like the sense of wanting to prove yourself when you've just had the chance taken away, where you're like, you really, really, really want to kind of get all those insecurities out and be like, I'm good enough for this. It was the chance to prove that you're good enough was delayed a year. But it's closer now, and I'll show you all very soon.
Can we talk a little bit about Team Pursuit? I mean, obviously, I'm a huge fan of your solo work, but we'll get to that in a second. I've always been, Team Pursuit is my, it's either my second or third favorite track discipline. Obviously, my heart belongs to the individual pursuit. And obviously there's no one who enjoys more an individual pursuit qualifying session than me. You know, the early mornings in a velodrome for 3 hours while unknown Ukrainians ride around the track. I cannot get enough of that. But let's talk a little bit about Team Pursuit. It's probably the most analysed event in cycling. Would that be fair?
Yeah, it would be. And I think it's always a bit of not a frustration. Likewise, fellow Team Pursuitophile. And just when you contrast it to the big American sports that are totally covered in analysis, you would characterize them more with your bunch races. Like how much analysis goes into a swimming race in the way that we've really taken Team Pursuit to pieces.
Katie is right about the way different analysis applies across different sports. But from a sports science point of view, Team Pursuit is an event that you can study almost endlessly. For an Olympics, the top teams will start off by working out what time they think is going to be needed to win, and then they go on to work out how you make a team go that quickly. You can calculate the power needed for each of the four riders in the string at any point, the recovery period, how much time you lose with each changeover, because you lose a bike length each time, obviously, and that's about a tenth of a second. You need to allow for the slipstream of the other team on the track, and for the fact that in a velodrome, the air swirls anti-clockwise around the track in the same direction as the racing. Exactly how much it swirls depends on the design of the building, and even what events have been running on the track before yours. So if you wanted to break the world record in a team pursuit, ideally you'd be onto the track for qualifying straight after a big bunch race had just finished. You can work out the torque each rider needs to get off the start line, and you can work out the rate at which each of them is burning through their anaerobic reserves. The big challenge is how you match that to the riders you've got. Dan Bigham's Hoob Watt Bike team were able to beat some of the bigger national teams at the World Cups a couple of seasons ago, and the main reason they could do that was their ability to adapt their racing strategy to the fact that they only had four slightly randomly chosen riders available within the team. One of their inventions was having the lead rider change into third place in the string rather than going back to fourth place at the very back, which gave that last rider an extra couple of laps recovery. There are as many ways to ride a team pursuit as there are team pursuit riders. It is absolutely fascinating. I watched a World Championship team pursuit with Simon Jones, who's a former GB performance director, then went to Australia. He'd been all over the place now. And we were watching with the men's event. You know, I honestly can't remember what year it was. It was in 2018 or 2019, sitting in the stands. And after a lap and a half, he went, ooh, that's not good. And he said, and I looked down at him and he said, wait. And about 2.5 kilometres later, it all fell apart. And is that kind of, and I think Simon could spot that because he's been through so much of the performance analysis that he knows what to look for very early on. And I don't think anyone is smart enough to watch everything and remember everything to just intuit that. I think that comes from the analysis. And I don't know. I mean, I wrote a few team pursuits long, long ago in the days when they shouted go and off you went. And there was nothing like the amount of effort put into it. I honestly don't know, from your point of view, whether the number of the rehearsals you can do, the race simulation you can do, the analysis you can do, the videos you can watch, I don't know whether that makes it harder or easier as an athlete. Does it mean you have to think about more, or does it mean you have to think about less?
What's funny about that story is that it kind of, it can paint team pursuit as both an exact science and also as something that can go wrong. So how does it go wrong if we know that you shouldn't go out too hard, if we know that this is the lap split that we're after? And we have a coach on the sidelines that's walk us to a tenth. And it doesn't sound like a lot. I guess if you were to visualize a tenth in the speed and have it laying out as a distance, people would maybe understand more how you can really feel, on occasions you can really feel a tenth. And I think the biggest thing for me that the analysis brings is a translation of sensation. So it wouldn't really work. You can't take someone straight in and start explaining their ride to them and think that'll make them better in their second ride. They almost have to spend a year feeling the input, having that displayed as an output, and then putting the two together to create better feedback conversations and sort of quicker evolution of agreement, ideas, and sort of the way to ride. And that's what kind of bugs me if ever somebody, like if we come off a team pursuit ride and nobody will want to have a conversation or want to look at the graph. And actually that basically never happens, because we're all in pretty strong agreement that you should be able to have a conversation that paints a graph, that can tell you exactly what the video is going to look like, that will tell you what, like even if you don't know what the opening split was, you'll know if it was too fast, you know? And these maybe sound like obvious things, but there's still like a great satisfaction being years and years into this event that's really quite niche, and to have such an intimate understanding of something that's you know, it's a bit stupid, isn't it? It's
like it is a little trivial. I mean, it's not developing vaccines, is it?
It's not developing vaccines, but I can tell you how somebody feels, or how this small group of people, how they feel based on the way that their hips move. I can tell you, like, I can shout at you to correct what is going wrong at any given time. You know, it's this really odd but satisfying feeling of really knowing what you're doing.
Successful riders are usually a lot like Katie. They're immersed in the world of their events. If you ask a road sprinter like Mark Cavendish to tell you about the run into a finish, you'll realise that there's almost no detail they won't have logged. So it's not surprising that in the controlled environment of track racing, that goes double. But they're not doing it on their own either. They've got coaches, they've got physiologists, they've got lots of staff that we're pretty familiar with. But there's also one you hear a bit less about, and that's the performance analyst. Their job is to break down the demands of the event, the abilities of rivals, and to rake through the really fine details of the rider's performance so they can work out exactly what they're going to have to do to win. I wanted to hear a little bit more about this side of things, so I talked to Steph Blair, who's been a performance analyst at British Cycling for the last 3 years. I asked her what her role entails.
The role really of the performance analyst comes in to help work alongside the coach and the different practitioners to provide the data basically to back up some of the interventions that we're trying to put in place. And they're really seen as the gatekeeper that houses all the information that we're getting both from the athlete and coming in from the coaches, just to help provide more objective decisions and help check and challenge the interventions and identify any gaps of where we can help improve that performance. So obviously we've got the power meters and all the instrumentation within the bikes. We're tracking things like power, torque, cadence, alongside providing a video and analysis, so we can also get some feedback into what, from a tactical point of view, what's happened during that session. Within the background, those are basically just the basic measures that are coming through off the bike. And then we've got a lot of complex models and algorithms that can help just take that a wee bit further for us to really unpick that performance. Trying to take each pieces of those information, so looking at video both from a positional aspect as well as to, we know that aerodynamics plays a big part in a lot of the endurance-based events, so we're using both video to provide an overview of what their position looks like on the bike, not only at the start of an event, but also how that changes throughout it. Also using it for, as you mentioned, looking at, can we relate that information to their position on the track, how they've actually approached that race, and along then with things like tactical feedback. So if we were simulating things like a Madison or an Omnium, kind of what strategies did we put in place? Did the athlete then, how did they run with them throughout that course? And then we kind of tie that then in with the data coming off the bike. So looking at their power and their cadence to see how that all relates then together. it almost helps evaluate what the coach is saying too. So if they're thinking, oh right, we've seen this aspect of performance, has that translated through? Does the data give us the same sort of decision?
I find myself wondering just how well the riders deal with all of this, because it's a lot of information and a lot of it can clearly be quite complicated. I asked Steph if it's a case of it being more for the benefit of the coaches or whether all of this information normally goes directly to the riders.
It's one of very few sports actually where the athletes are very involved in the process, and I think that's because they've got quite a good technical understanding of the different parameters and KPIs that we're looking for within it, which is quite nice because then you can bring everyone in on the picture. And I guess that just stems from the fact that cycling, even as an amateur sport, you get so much data that comes through. And even at an amateur level, athletes are exposed to this type of information. So then once you take them into an elite scenario, you can really push and challenge them and have these high-level conversations. You'll have a few, the likes of Katie, that are really involved in the data side of things and get a good understanding, whereas there's some that's just like, right, just tell me what I need to know. Again, it's very individual, and I guess you get to know that with working alongside different athletes and how they respond. And I think as an analyst, that's where then we come in to try and adjust the way we deliver things. And sometimes that can be different between athletes, but also different coaches.
It's one of the things that I enjoy about Team Pursuit is that most of the rest of cycling, I mean, I've described cycling in the past as a skill-free sport. I tend to be a little bit careful about who I describe cycling as a skill-free sport to. But if you've got the engine, there are a lot of cycling events that aren't all that difficult. I mean, if you've got the engine, individual pursuit is not very complicated. If you've got the engine, time trialing is not very complicated. Team pursuit's the absolute opposite. It looks complicated. It is complicated. Watching it on television or watching it on the track, I'm always just astonished by the precision under such physical duress. Because that's what people miss about it, is that it's only a 4-minute event. It's physically really hard.
Brilliant morale boost was Blue Peter once had one of their presenters come to a revolution. That had been training. A revolution was, you'll know this, but a series of track races. And this Blue Peter presenter had been training for a flying lap, I think it was. And so this was the big day that they would do their flying lap, and it would be on the TV or whatever. And you have no idea how good it felt to see a normal person just make it look so hard, to make it just look impossible to ride a track bike, impossible to ride the black line. Just the whole thing. It looked like he was in a space rocket, but he'd not been to NASA, you know. And I'm there like, thank you, you know, a bit of respect for what we're about to go and do that might sometimes look boring because you're doing it right, I guess.
Just a quick footnote here, if you're not from the UK, Blue Peter is a UK children's television show which specialises in sending presenters off to try doing things they're not really qualified to do, like track cycling. Although, actually looking around the state of UK politics at the minute, the concept of only being allowed to do something because you're qualified to do it does seem rather redundant. And it's like the start of a pursuit or a team pursuit, it looks on TV like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go, and you are off your ride. And the difficulty of doing the kind of the, you know, the 8-second half lap.
Yeah, well, I do have that same instinct and enjoyment in trying to plot different sports on where they lie in terms of physicality, technicality, physiology versus like nature and nurture, and kind of like your footballs and your 100 meter sprints, and sort of where's the middle ground? And I think you can see enough talent transfer into cycling to assume that, unlike swimming, unlike gymnastics, unlike football, there's a big enough physiological component that if somebody can pick up a bike and transfer what they've got, I guess, yeah, that kind of supports your supports your viewpoint, I guess. And likewise, I guess one of my big pushbacks to that would be the tactical aspects. But that doesn't, I don't think that falls into a skill set. It's,
I wouldn't call that a skill. That's, you know, you can learn to do that. Applying it under pressure, that's a skill, but it's not an impossible skill.
Well, so two different routes. I can definitely recognise that in my teammates. I would say the Laura Kennys of the world who learn by instinct, and her racecraft, I don't think, like she, one of the smartest people I know. And I find it so pleasurable because she's one of the smartest people I know, but the stupid things like she can't spell. And so, like, but you know, but I would go to her for mortgage advice, you know, like, so what, she's not going to redraft an essay for me. But it's the same of like, she won't always be able to explicitly tell you what you should do in a race, but she will know what she is doing. And it can't always be verbalized for you, but her legs do it, her hands do it, her eyes know where to look, her elbows know where to shove, kind of thing. And it comes from this learning of exposure and being in the races far more than I would say myself, and maybe like an Emily Nelson of the world, who kind of obsess a lot over the like the analysis and the decision making, going into a race with a plan and saying this is how I'm going to approach it. And like both have the risks and both have the rewards, but.
So if we talk about kind of the analysis of team pursuit, I mean, every team pursuit training session is every team pursuit training session supported by performance analysis, video, you know, there's the little caravan that they've got at Manchester in one end of the day with the screens and the rest of it. And you can see, and particularly, you know, the squad riders sitting gathered in a little circle on chairs around the caravan while someone delivers a little lecture on what has just happened and whether it was good or whether it was bad. That's every session, is it?
Yeah, the caravan's been retired with COVID, but we still, so we're all in these really big socially distanced pens. We're all huddled around a small laptop now, but just only our team, around your own sort of like individual laptop. And every effort is filmed. We don't film our warm up. Sometimes you want to, just so you can say like, did you see what happened there? every effort is filmed. Every effort has a sort of basic feedback sheet that'll involve our lap splits, our powers, the sort of cadence with those powers. Let me think. We used to track delivery split. So this is your speed as you exit a turn. And we used to track that as seemingly an important measure for how you're delivering the... God, I'll stop with the finger quotations. I swear I'm not that kind of person.
go ahead. I love kind of people who do punctuation with their fingers.
Yeah. And that's something that we've recently canned. So that's an inside scoop for you. Decided that's useless. We've kind of rattled through performance analysts and it breaks my heart. We had one through the Rio cycle, and she's actually, she left and subsequently came back to British Cycling in a different role. But then we had Roby Day left for the BBC, Lucas, our most recent one, I think he's left back to Canada and now we're on to Sophie Straw is our current performance analyst. And you sort of, on one hand, you're pulling your hair out thinking like, I've just built a relationship with this person for how I want to interpret the data. On the other hand, there has been an interesting evolution with each different analyst that we get that will say like, that's useless. Why are you doing that? Why don't we bring this in? And it kind of punts it forwards. But I just wish we could punt it forwards, maybe just 4 years at a time. so I could build a relationship with these people. And I'm hoping Sophie stays for a good while.
How much of that do you then take across to the bunch race events? Because to the team pursuit is so controlled and so precise. How much of that kind of analysis can you bring to Madison or to Omnium events or points race?
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago now. I was sat in a hotel lobby working away on my laptop, and one of my teammates comes and sits next to me, and I don't really stop what I'm doing, but I don't know what we're both waiting for. And one of the men, one of the men's teams comes over and goes like, oh, what are you doing? And my teammate goes, oh, Katie's just figuring out the algorithm for how you win a Madison. And I was mortified because obviously this is like, I won't say who it was, but another, like a male rider into the bunch racing, sort of like, I was so ready for the eye roll of that. I think you'll find there isn't a formula for winning bunch race, because there isn't. There definitely isn't. I wasn't claiming there was. But I just don't see there being any harm in breaking down statistical trends. So what's been so much fun about the Madison project of the Tokyo Olympics, what I guess I should maybe take a few steps back. I guess I'm calling it the Madison Project because this will be the first time there's been a women's Madison at the Olympics. It was a like hallmark event of the men's track cycling program. It was taken out in 2012 when they equaled the event opportunity, the medal opportunity for men and women. They brought in the Omnium, took out the points race, took out the individual pursuit, brought in the team pursuit. There's always been, I know from speaking, like I've heard other people say with a sense of kind of embarrassment and frustration that they knew that the men were annoyed that to give the women their medals, they'd taken one away. And, but the truth of it was, Chris Hoy is Britain's most successful, Chris Hoy and Jason Kenny, Britain's most successful Olympic champions. And Chris Hoy's peer, Victoria Pendleton, could have never contended to have the same success. So now we both have an extra medal brought into this Olympic program, and that is the Madison. And it is a new world
championship. You've worked out how to win it.
Yeah, I've got the maths. I'll share it with you after, if you promise not to tell. but because it was a new event, it meant that there was just such a raw starting point to think, well, I don't really have anybody handing down their history to me. They also changed the rules at the same time. So the history of the Madison that the men are tied into follow different rules to the current Madison event.
I thought it might be helpful to explain the changes to the Madison event. Not only has the UCI, a mere 125 years after the Madison was invented, finally allowed women to ride it, they've changed the rules. The old rule was that laps gained on the rest of the bunch were paramount. If you were a lap up on everyone else, you were winning, and it didn't matter if you had fewer points won from sprints than some of the other teams. Those sprinting points were only used to separate teams that were on the same lap. Now, a lap gain isn't a trump on everybody else. A lap gain is just 20 points, so it's the equivalent of winning 4 sprints. And there are sprints every 10 laps, whereas it used to be every 20 laps, so there's twice as many sprints. The overall effect of that is that sprints are worth a lot more, laps are worth a lot less, and it's all very different in terms of the tactics. I asked Katie about all of this.
I would say, and I don't know whether this is just easy to, like an easy critique to make, and there's probably other factors that contribute to this, but I would say that the men's event, I think, still carries a lot of the riding style that applied to that format. And I don't think you see that in the women's race as much. There is a far more predictable flow around the points, around the sprints. And it's still, like, I should probably make it really, really clear, there isn't a winning formula. But there are slightly more predictable patterns, certainly at this point, it seems. What was kind of fun is that you're trying to, like, analyze this data that's evolving so quickly because more nations are building more depth and the racing standard is going up. But I was saying in the last couple of years, there's been some kind of really solid competition that you can make predictions on the strengths of the top nations.
And that was kind of, is that going down to kind of individuals about who's likely to go for a lap early, who's likely to go too early, who's going to leave it possibly too late? And it just, you just go in armed with a lot more knowledge about the competition. Are you working more independently of them? There's a difference in tactics and strategy, I suppose. Do you work out what your strategy is, when is the best moment in a Madison to get a lap? And that would never move in any Madison. There'll always be an optimum point in the average of every Madison they've ever been. So we're going to go at 10 kilometers to go. I'm not expressing this particularly badly, but that balance between whether you're responding to what's happening around you or whether you go in with a plan and stick to it, I suppose, is the question.
Yeah, so I'd break that into two separate parts. So there's one part of approaching a race knowing who you're racing against, and so knowing the trends, the strengths, the idiosyncrasies of your competitors. And then there's another part that's knowing your shorthand for the race. So things like how often does a team win 3 sprints in a row? How often does the winning team take a lap? How often how regularly does a typical podium team score? This is a really easy one that I'll share. I don't know why. I, I'm I'm quite certain that every other nation is doing the same thing and knows all of these things. But like a rule of thumb would be like 9 out of 10 times, the position that you enter a sprint lap is the position that you exit a sprint lap. As in, if you are trying to get your partner in on bell lap, which would be your sort of like your optimal, I want to get my partner in with one lap to go. The position that you put them in is going to be where they come out. So who is it that's really sprinted? Is it the person that crossed the finish line and took the points? No, it's the person that entered that other rider. Sure, the other rider has to ride hard, but they have to ride hard for like 15 seconds in a straight line. And that, like, that, yeah. So how many times can you put that stress on the entering rider? How typically, where is the leading team positioned when an attack goes? There's lots of kind of fun questions you can ask, and some of them have interesting answers, and a lot of them don't. And it's frustrating that there aren't really enough hours in a day, or certainly I haven't dedicated enough hours in a day to answer all of these questions. But I think the process of going through them, even if the answers themselves aren't useful, I think that the process has been a really useful educational tool.
I just love this sort of approach to a bike race. It's calmly taking the race apart into its component elements and see how they typically fit together. As Katie says, there's no algorithm, but the more you analyse what's going on in a Madison, or in any other race for that matter, the more you improve your odds. It means that instead of starting the race with nothing much more in your mind other than an end goal of winning, followed by an hour or so of giving it your best guess, you have process goals along the way. You've got intermediate targets about where you want to be positioned, when you want to be there, how the two riders are going to share the workload, and you've got a framework you can use to tell whether things are going well or going badly at any moment in the race. It improves the decision-making by reducing the amount of guessing a rider has to do at a point where they're probably also riding flat out. And one of the nice knock-on effects of that is that it makes the whole process of riding the most chaotic-looking race into something much simpler to deal with and a lot less nerve-shredding. It's like an accelerated way to gain experience in an event. You might, say, only have ridden a dozen international-level Madisons, but mentally, you've maybe been through 2 or 3 dozen international level Madisons. Experience counts, and this is a way to gain experience. When it all goes wrong, why does it go wrong? Either, you know, in team pursuit or in Madison or anything else on track, you know, what are the key stages to disaster in a race? Particularly, let's say team pursuit, because when team pursuit goes wrong, it goes wrong very quickly. But it often doesn't go wrong for what looks like the obvious reason, because whoever it is who loses the wheel tends to be the one who gets the blame.
Oh my goodness, I know. And that's what's so frustrating, of the emotional attachment that someone can have to a failure can really, really alter the commitment and the confidence that they'll go into the next ride with. And so you really want to make sure that you understand why this has gone wrong. Because if somebody has the wrong impression, then they're too scared to try something next time. So, like, because if somebody thinks, well, you know, you made me do that 2.5 lap first turn, and I was so in the red that I couldn't do it, we're never doing that again. But it could be that the pace has accelerated, like someone's kicked through on them, for example.
Just to clarify here, kicking through is when the second rider in the team suddenly accelerates just as the first rider pulls off the line, so that everybody else has to make an effort to close the gaps, and the rider who's just finished their turn has to dig deeper than they were ready for to get hooked onto the back of the team. It comes under the heading of not a good thing, and if you do it in a major event, you will not be allowed to forget it in a hurry. It used to be very much my speciality.
That sounds like an easy... like an easy thing to see, but it isn't always. So I'd say an important debrief is super important, because you want to know, like you say, why has it gone wrong? So British team pursuiters, there's pretty much only three words that we shout. It's only in the last couple of years that we've introduced a fourth. So shout.
The British team pursuit team have learned a fourth word here in the Olympics.
Oh goodness, I hope not. And I'll tell you why soon.
Okay.
We had squeeze, which means accelerate. Funny tangent side story. When I was very new to the squad, nobody told me these things. My first session training with the team, I wasn't on the squad at the time, my first session training with the team, and I'm getting all these shouts of squeeze, but nobody told me this language. So all I can hear is what I think is people saying easy. And I'm like, oh my God, day one, am I already going too fast? I am so good at this. Squeeze means accelerate. Hold means don't accelerate. So we don't have a word that means slow down. The concept is you never want to slow down, but there is a tone of voice that someone will shout hold with that you know it means something far more emotive than no more accelerating. So squeeze, hold, and three. We shout three to mean somebody's, there's a rider dropped, not necessarily a bad thing, maybe they plan to bail. Only three people have to finish. So we'll shout three, which means that people know to change for three riders rather than four. The new one that we won't be hearing at Tokyo is gap. So like I said, we don't have a word that means slow down. And so I've actually been in races before where I've heard someone shouting hold behind. I've come around and I've seen the coach pulling his arms towards me and saying like, come on, like up, up, up. Like it was maybe the last 500 meters or something. So I've got one person shouting hold, another person being like rinse it through to the finish. So I rinsed it, the team blew to pieces. And we needed, you need something more than hold in those situations. I don't think we've actually used it in a competition, but on paper, the agreement is that we'll now shout hold. But hopefully you just hope your coach says it. What was the actual question though? I'm sure it was
what was the actual question? Well, the question was when it goes wrong, why does it go wrong? Which you've answered about 75% of.
Yeah, I guess it's not listening to hold when it's screamed at you. But no, it's basically the most efficient way to get from A to B is to go on the exact lap split that your physiologist has told you you're all capable of and just hold it exactly there until you get to exactly zero. Tank goes empty right at the very finish, and that never happens. So if you accept that isn't going to happen, it's probably slightly more efficient to go a little bit too hard and then sort of like tail off towards the end. Most nations fall into that pattern. The Americans, they probably go too far the other way of like proper just rip it out the start. They're probably the fastest starters that you'll see. And the current trend actually is that they finish quite strong as well, with just a sort of like banana in the middle. it just goes wrong when somebody loses that translation from, or loses the calibration, sorry, that we actually spend months dialing into. And then you get really nervous, so you just go as hard as you can for one lap when you were meant to go as hard as you can for 16.
The Great Britain Cycling Team is a big organisation. I mean, it's bigger than a lot of other superficially quite similar teams. And there's a lot of time and money going into trying to win things. If you're one of the relatively small number of podium-level riders, does the sheer scale of the thing and the momentum produce a feeling of pressure?
It's quite interesting to frame it like that, because when we reflect on ourselves as riders, I think the team is quite aware of how big a sport we are, because cycling encompasses track cycling, road cycling, mountain biking, BMX supercross, BMX freestyle. There's going to be someone I've offended and forgotten. I mean, there's the cross riders, but they don't do the Olympics. So in terms of UK sport, funded sports, we're in part such a monstrous organization because we encompass so many different if you contrast it to swimming, for example, I think maybe swimming and diving, and there'll be another aquatics that kind of come under the same umbrella, so maybe they have the same kind of benefits where we use our own gym that's just for cycling, we have our own physio team that's just for the cyclists, because you're looking at something, there's over 100, is that true? I feel like there's probably about 100 riders, because there's, like I say, so many different sports. Cycling disciplines. I think it is super intimidating when you first gain entry to the club. I think it doesn't take long before you start to probably roll your eyes and go too far the other way of assuming that if you knew what it was really like, you wouldn't give them a second. You know, like just that way of when you're so intimidated by something, you can never live up to those expectations. So you want to joke that like, oh, you think we're fancy, but it's all a piece of shit, you know, like the pendulum swings either way. And probably in a public setting like this, if I were to advertise the strength of British cycling, I think there is a lot of truth in the stature that they hold, the backing of sports science, the probably like the the impressions that you've gotten of how to create excellence and the people that build those cultures, and they are in that building, and they are high performers.
Katie isn't the only pro cyclist in her family. Her brother John Archibald has represented Great Britain and Scotland, and he's a World Championships and Commonwealth Games medalist. A little bit more snooping on the internet dug up sister Rosie Archibald, who's an international runner. And Katie's father Ian was a 4-minute mile middle distance runner. If you line all of that up, you realise this is too good an opportunity to miss to have a look at the questions of genetics versus environment in producing elite athletes. So I asked Katie what her take on that debate was.
Well, when I was 7, my dad picked me and my brother up. I think my mum was in the car as well. It took us, we get in the car and we drive 3 hours or whatever. And you know, when you're kids, you don't really question, you just get in the car, you just do whatever. So we drive 3 hours and we get out of the car the other side, and I'm 7 years old, and my dad says, I'm just going to go and get your sister. And at this point, I didn't actually realise I had a sister. So Rose is my half-sister. So she grew up in Durham, and my dad was a runner, and she, as a youngster, well, I guess through, she's in her 30s now, and doesn't run quite as competitively anymore, but her whole life has been a really quite successful runner. And I guess we can say that that's had very little to do with the influence of my father in her childhood, environmentally, but more more physiologically, obviously, a lot of her mum in there too.
Well, it's like they've been doing experiments on you.
Yeah, I have a professional footballer cousin also. My cousin Theo Archibald, if you want to give him a... Let's just Google everyone.
I'm Googling members of Katie Archibald's family. I mean, that's kind of... It's my hobby.
The Edinburgh Archibalds, my cousins in Edinburgh. So Theo, he's West Coast like us, but they're cool as well. My cousin Callum is into parkour. Are you familiar with parkour?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah, so I think that's a family favourite because, for example, when he was at school, he 1 year he won the school long jump doing a somersault into the sand pit. Like, he had such a natural talent for jumping that he didn't have to take the jumping competition seriously to win it. I don't know much about the sport myself, but I got it. He looks very impressive at the old parkour. we've got, like, there's thumbs in pies. What's the phrase? There's a lot about, and my most like pleasing way to wrap it all up in a neat bow that has no answers, but just to like contribute to the questions. My father was a 4-minute mile runner. My brother, through most of his swimming career, which is what he tried to take to a high level to begin with. He's now making it as a cyclist, but he wanted to make it as a swimmer. Was 400 meter freestyle was his event. So my father's 4-minute mile runner. My brother's a 4-minute 400 meter swimmer. I don't actually know what his PB. Hopefully it's faster than that. But and I'm a pursuer, and the world record is 4 minutes 10 seconds. And so you say, what is it that's drawn us all to these sort of like 3 to 5 minute, well, actually explicitly 4 minute milestones? With 4 minute family, and we all like to put it down to the mitochondria my mother gave us, but there's something that my dad's had a hand in. The kind of secondary conversation that springs from that of like where you're mapping genes for performance, and we've said it like it's quite a simple thing of the perfect athlete, as though we can mark down which traits create the perfect athlete, because the thing that gets overlooked all the time is how much of a genetic influence is involved in your motivation, in your perceived pain, in I can't think of other examples, but basically like the sort of the things that make a, whether it's a hard worker or a smart worker, the things that contribute to the things that you think are controllable. And like, even, I guess we can go further back. You talk about like genes that get switched on or off depending on like what happened in your childhood. And then you get even more frustrated if like, God, it's not just my mum's fault I've not got enough mitochondria. It's my mum's fault I can't catch a ball. And I think that's when it, because I know that there's a lot of athletes that take a lot of pride in saying, you know, I'm not very good. I'm not actually very good at the sport. I just try really hard. And it's like, oh, where'd you get the try hard from? Who gave you the try hard? You know?
Thanks to Katie Archibald and to Steph Blair. Thanks to you for listening. And of course, my thanks to Cycling Weekly magazine for supporting the show. If you like this episode, please tell your friends about it. It really helps people to find us. It'd be great if you could like and subscribe to Faster and rate it as well. You can find me on Twitter at Dr_Hutch if you want to get in touch. And if you want to read the book that inspired the podcast, it's also called Faster, and it's available from places that sell books both online and in real life. Faster is produced, mixed, and edited by Tom Wally and the team at Stripped Media.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.